divided into three groups based on the number of 8-ounce milkshakes given, none, one, and two shakes. After drinking the shakes, the subjects were asked to taste and rate three flavors of ice cream. They were allowed to eat as much ice cream as they wanted and taste tested in privacy to guard against self-consciousness. The researchers saw to it that ample ice cream was provided so that substantial amounts could be eaten without making an appreciable dent in the supply. Here's what happened. The non-dieters naturally regulated their eating. They ate less ice cream in proportion to the amount of milkshakes consumed. The dieters, however, had a dramatic opposite behavior. Those who drank two milkshakes ate the most ice cream, a counter-regulation effect. The researchers concluded that forcing the dieters to overeat or blow their diet caused them to release their food inhibitions. With inhibition banished, restraint was eliminated, and the dieters overate the ice cream. Perception affects eating. Another similar study examined the notion of how dieters perceive calories. All subjects were given snacks of chocolate pudding with a substantial calorie difference. One group was given a high-calorie pudding, and another was given a lower-calorie version. But within each of these groups, half of the subjects were told that the pudding was high in calories, and half were told that it was low. Then the subjects were given a pseudo-taste test. The dieters who thought the pudding was high in calories ate more than the dieters who thought the pudding was low in calories, by 61%. This study illustrates how much power thoughts and perception can have on eating behavior. And once again, when the dieter blew the diet, whether actual or perceived, overeating ensued. The seesaw syndrome, guilt versus deprivation. The longer foods are prohibited, the more seductive they become. Consequently, eating these illegal foods brings with it a compelling sense of guilt for most dieters. And as the guilt increases, so does the quantity of food intake. The more deprived you become from dieting and from specific foods, the greater the deprivation backlash. We see this all the time. We call it the seesaw syndrome. When it comes to dieting, feelings of deprivation and guilt work in an opposing manner, like two kids on a seesaw. What goes up must come down. When dieting, as you restrict foods that you enjoy eating, deprivation becomes higher and higher. Meanwhile, in tandem, guilty feelings go down because you haven't eaten any bad foods. But there's a limit to which the seesaw can climb. The level of deprivation rises to its highest point, where you can't bear one more meal, let alone one more day of restrictive eating. Meanwhile, guilty feelings are at their lowest because you have not eaten any forbidden foods. You've been good. Since you have no buildup of guilt, you're wide open to allow some forbidden foods into your life and able to tolerate the beginning feelings of guilt that these foods engender. As you eat the first forbidden food, you begin to feel guilt. That guilt triggers feelings of being bad, which lead you to more food, the what-the-hell effect, with its accompanying guilt. Now the seesaw looks like a tug-of-war. After a while, the guilt continues to build, and in tandem, deprivation begins to recede. As the days go by, you feel worse about breaking your diet rules, and guilt rises to its highest point. Deprivation feelings are virtually non-existent because you've been eating all the foods that weren't allowed on the diet. At this point, the syndrome repeats itself, up and down, up and down, every time you go from diet to binge, diet to binge. The only way to get off this seesaw is to lighten up and let go of the deprivation. And just as when one kid decides to get off the seesaw, the other is forced to stop playing, when you give yourself permission to not be deprived, you simultaneously let go of the guilt. By giving yourself permission to eat, you stop playing the futile seesaw game. The key: unconditional permission to eat. The key to abolishing the pattern of restraint and subsequent overeating is to give yourself unconditional permission to eat. This means throwing out the preconceived notion that certain foods are good and others are bad. No one food has the power to make you fat or help you to become slim. Eating what you really want. Yes, what you want. Eating without obligatory penance. Okay, I can have the cheesecake now, but tomorrow I diet. These kinds of personal food deals are not unconditional. When you truly free your food choices, without any hidden agenda of restricting them in the future, you eliminate the urgency to overeat. Yet it's an unsettling prospect to most of our clients, even more frightening than the initial idea of giving up diets. The peace process. Making peace with food means allowing all foods into your eating world, so that a choice for chocolate becomes emotionally equal to a choice for a peach. It also means that your food choices do not reflect your character or morality. While for years, many health professionals have agreed that there should be no forbidden foods, very few will go the distance and say, eat whatever you want. Eventually, there is a limit imposed. And knowing there is a limit can still impart a food lust of sorts. Better eat it now. Ironically, once you truly know you can eat whatever you want, the intensity to eat greatly diminishes. The most effective way to instill this belief is to experience eating the very foods you forbid. It becomes self-evident proof that you can handle these foods, or better yet, that they have no magic hold on you or your willpower. Ironically, once again, many of our clients discover that the very foods that they had prohibited and craved are no longer desirable once they can be eaten freely. Over and over, we hear stories of how when they were truly allowed to eat certain foods, they discovered, to their surprise, that they really didn't like the foods to begin with. For example, Molly had relished bakery birthday cakes, but tried not to eat them. She would, however, eventually relent, especially at a party, and power through two or more pieces. But when she decided to make peace with food and come face to face with official permission, she found that she did not care for most bakery birthday cakes. She had always eaten them so fast, often on the sly, that she had not truly experienced the taste and texture of the cake. With her newfound permission, Molly took the time to taste the cake, whether in the privacy of her home or at a party. She found more often than not that the cakes were stale or bland and would not finish a single piece, let alone go for more pieces. Eventually, Molly would not settle for cakes that were less than superb. She now often turns down cake at parties because she wants to, not because she is a diet martyr. Annie had a similar taste experience. Her commitment to making peace with food sparked an enthusiasm for taste sensations that had been buried by her restrained eating. Annie gave herself unconditional permission to experience forbidden foods one at a time, day after day, often in preference to all other foods. Annie went through her red licorice phase, her Pop-Tarts phase, and her mashed potato phase. While in the midst of each phase, she ate the favored food with relish and delight. For some foods, she found that it took a few weeks for the desire to peak and then slowly taper off. For other foods, it took longer. And for a few, she found that they didn't taste half as good as she had imagined. To Annie's surprise and delight, she discovered that once she completed a particular food-freeing phase, she found that she stopped craving that food, hardly ever thought of it, and sometimes was so sick of it that she never wanted it again. Removing deprivation from Annie's eating diminished the alluring quality of foods and, instead, put them in a reasonable, rational perspective. Fears that hold you back. Even clients who come, ready to give up dieting, have a strong resistance to eating whatever they really want. They are terrified. While they feel comfortable learning to honor their hunger, they are ready to bolt out the door when we talk about giving unconditional permission to eat what they like. If people are so afraid to advance to this part of the intuitive eating process, why do we insist that this must be explored? Legalizing food is the critical step in changing your relationship with food. It frees you to respond to inner eating signals that have been smothered by negative thoughts and guilt feelings about eating. When you don't truly believe that you can eat whatever food you like, you will continue to feel deprived, ultimately overeat, and be blocked from feeling satisfied with your eating. And when you are not satisfied, you will be on the prowl for more food. When you know the food will be there and allowed, day after day, it doesn't become so important to have it. Food loses its power. In spite of the knowledge that deprivation leads to backlash eating, many people are apprehensive to make this peace pact with food, in part due to the following obstacles. I won't stop eating. At first, you may experience an overpowering fear that you won't stop eating a favorite forbidden food. Just remember that when you know that previously forbidden foods will always be allowed, the urgency to have large quantities of them eventually dissipates. Also, research shows that people will tire of eating the same kind of food. It's called habituation. Habituation studies have shown that the more a person is exposed to a particular food, the less appealing it becomes. In fact, you may have already witnessed this type of eating in other people. For example, observe the all-you-can-eat buffet dining that is popular in vacation spots, such as Las Vegas. On the first day, people typically load up their plates and grab three or four desserts. By the last day, however, they are choosing their food selectively. The novelty has worn off, and they know there is plenty of food. My entire family recently encountered the habituation effect when I was working on a 200-recipe cookbook. Whether I was testing salads, appetizers, or casseroles, we eventually tired of eating the same kinds of food. This was especially evident while creating the dessert chapter. Not only did we tire of eating sweets, but one family member to this day cannot bear to take a bite of pineapple upside-down cake, which was once his favorite. I made that particular cake at least 8 times before I decided to give up on that particular recipe. The only way that you will come to believe that you will be able to stop eating is to go through the food experience, to actually eat. That's why we are fond of the word process. This is not about knowledge of food, but rather rebuilding experiences with eating. You cannot have an experience through knowledge. Rather, you need to go through it, bite by bite. Otherwise, it would be like trying to learn how to play the guitar by reading a book on music theory. You may understand the components, but only when you practice and struggle with the strings personally will you truly know how to play. And the more you practice, the more confidence you will have. Sometimes people express a fear about being addicted to food. There are many reasons other than addiction that can explain the reward aspect of eating. For more information, see Can You Really Be Addicted to Food? Pseudo-permission. I've tried it before. Many of our clients will recount that when they allowed themselves to eat certain forbidden foods, they still overate and felt out of control. But for most people, these foods were never really unconditionally allowed. Rather, they were only given pseudo-permission. These forbidden foods were actually being eaten with a sense of temporarily breaking the rules, or with a little voice saying, "You really shouldn't eat that." The moment that food touched the tongue, feelings of guilt and remorse flooded in. And with these feelings, came a conviction to limit these foods in the future and counter this indulgence by eating right tomorrow. Although physically eating the food, they were emotionally depriving themselves in the future. And so the cycle perpetuates. Pseudo-permission does not work. It's only an illusion. Your mouth may be chewing, but your mind is saying, I shouldn't. Your mind is still on a diet. Self-fulfilling prophecy. Sometimes just the thought that you will overeat is enough to actually make you overeat. Carolyn initially had held the strong conviction that white flour would cause her to overeat. She believed that even one bite of a bagel would trigger a binge. And it did. Carolyn had created a self-fulfilling prophecy. She knew these foods were fattening, she knew she would binge, and she knew she would gain weight. Every time she gave in to her craving for white bread, she sincerely told herself that this would be the last time. Of course, she ended up overdoing it. The depriving thoughts and feelings, along with her sense of being bad, sent her out of control. It took a long time before Carolyn was truly able to permit herself to eat foods with white flour. But now she rarely binges on these foods. Every now and then a fleeting, archaic thought of restriction occurs and drags her back to the world of deprivation. And with that thought comes her occasional sense of loss of control. Now, though, she only has a few cookies instead of the whole bag. And this happens once every 6 months instead of every week. Because Carolyn has had so many positive experiences with foods containing white flour, it has become much easier for her to let go of her restrictive thinking and make peace with these foods. I won't eat healthfully. In case after case, when people are given free choice and access to all varieties of food, after going through the peace process, they end up balancing their intake to include mostly nutritious foods with a smattering of play foods. As nutritionists, we continue to honor and respect nutrition. But at this point in the intuitive eating process, nutrition is not the driving force. If nutrition were the overriding priority now, it would only perpetuate your restrictive thoughts. It took us years to come to terms with this factor, and it is why nutrition issues are reserved for later in this book. As you go further along with the process, and all foods are completely allowed, your intuitive signals will give you good advice. But even right now, if you think about eating a hot fudge sundae for every meal, how soon do you think you will be craving something completely opposite, such as a salad or a piece of grilled chicken? Lack of self-trust. A mighty obstacle to making peace with food is a strong lack of self-trust. Most clients say that they intellectually trust us and our philosophy. They truly believe that it has worked for other clients. But they distrust themselves and are frightened that it won't work for them. Ironically, the process of giving yourself permission to eat is actually the stepping stone to rebuilding your trust with food and with yourself. In the beginning, each positive food experience is like a tiny thread. They may be few and far between and seem insignificant, but eventually the threads form a strand. The strands multiply into strong ropes, and finally the ropes become the bridge to a foundation of trust in food and in yourself. Betsy was gaining weight by the moment when she first came in. She had been on several very restricted diets and was now rebound eating in an out-of-control fashion. After a short time of giving herself permission to eat, she began to find herself eating only one candy bar instead of three, which was a major breakthrough. At first, these experiences were sporadic, and her successes were interspersed with large gaps of binging behavior. But Betsy was gradually able to see her successes build upon each other and watch her overeating begin to gradually disappear. Soon she began to redevelop that sense of self-trust that had been eroded by her history of dieting. For some, the trust issue goes even deeper. Several studies have shown that the regulation of food intake has its foundation in early eating experiences. If, as a child, your parents took control over most of your eating without respecting your preferences or hunger levels, you easily got the message that you couldn't be trusted with food. Sarah described this as the push or pull away effect. Her mom was either pushing her to eat while exerting pressure about Sarah's weight or pulling food away. At dinner time, for example, Sarah's mom forced her to clean her plate, even though she was full. Sarah remembers coming home from school on several occasions feeling famished and heading to the fridge for a snack. Her mom would chastise her, "You can't be hungry," and forbid her to eat. Consequently, Sarah would sneak food when her mom wasn't looking. By that time, however, hunger was no longer mild, but intense. Sarah would overeat in response to hunger, but she felt guilty from overeating and shame from sneaking the food. And she grew to believe that her mother was right. She couldn't be trusted with food. Wrong. Don't underestimate the profound impact self-trust can have. Psychoanalyst Erik Erikson, a noted pioneer in human development, explains how critical trust is. According to Erikson, all people must go through a series of stages throughout their lives. The first developmental stage deals with basic trust. During each stage, there is a significant issue or crisis that presents itself and must be resolved. If this task is not handled well, a person will continue to struggle with it into adulthood. If food becomes a battleground during this stage, the ability to trust yourself with food becomes tarnished. The "you can't be trusted around food" message becomes compounded if you were put on diets by your parents or your doctor. As an adult, try as you may, you still don't trust yourself. That child can still reside within you, making you fearful to give yourself permission to eat unconditionally. Fortunately, Erikson had an optimistic belief that childhood crises can be resolved at any time later in life. If you take back ownership of your eating signals by making peace with food, you can heal one of the most basic trust issues and go on to a healthier relationship with food. 5 steps to make peace with food. Keep in mind as you read through these steps that it's okay to proceed at a pace with which you are comfortable. There is no need to feel overwhelmed by going to the grocery store and buying every single forbidden food. We find that is too big of a step, and not necessary. It takes time to build up trust in yourself. Before you proceed, please be sure that you are consistently honoring your hunger. A ravenous person is bound to overeat, regardless of his or her intention. 1. Pay attention to the foods that are appealing to you and make a list of them. 2. Put a check by the foods you actually do eat. Then circle remaining foods that you've been restricting. 3. Give yourself permission to eat one forbidden food from your list. Then go to the market and buy this food, or order it at a restaurant. 4. Check in with yourself to see if the food tastes as good as you imagined. If you find that you really like it, continue to give yourself permission to buy or order it. 5. Make sure that you keep enough of the food in your kitchen so that you know that it will be there if you want it. Or if that seems too scary, go to a restaurant and order the particular food as often as you like. Once you've made peace with one food, continue on with your list until all the foods are tried, evaluated, and freed. If your list is quite large, which is possible, we have found that you don't have to experience each and every food listed. Rather, what is important is that you continue this process until you truly know you can eat what you want. You will get to a point where you don't have to experience the proof by eating. If these steps seem like too much to handle right now, don't worry. Maybe you can call a ceasefire. That's okay. It's progress. The next chapter will give you some tools to help you loosen up with your food. Just as many peace treaties require a team of negotiators and time, the next chapter will help you discover powerful allies to help keep the peace with food. Beware of the "I can eat whatever I want as much as I want whenever I feel like it" trap. This perception, or trap, actually distorts the premise of intuitive eating. Yes, make peace with food and eat what pleases your palate. Yes, give yourself the freedom to eat unconditionally and eat as much as you need to satisfy your body. But eating whenever you feel like it, without regard to hunger and fullness, might not be a very satisfying experience, and might also cause physical discomfort. Attunement with your body's satiety cues is an important part of this process. Habituation response explains why foods become less enticing with exposure. One reason that having unconditional permission to eat is important is because of the habituation response. Habituation explains why we quickly adapt to a repeated experience and subsequently experience less pleasure each time. It's a universal phenomenon that applies in many situations, such as when you buy a new car. At first, it's super exciting, but then the novelty wears off. Or when you hear a special person say, "I love you," for the first time. It's magical. But then it becomes routine, and even expected. Psychologist and author Daniel Gilbert aptly describes habituation as, "Wonderful things are especially wonderful the first time they happen, but their wonderfulness wanes with repetition." Habituation is also one of the reasons why leftovers are less appealing, especially on days 2 and 3. When you eat a food over and over, it simply loses its appeal. There is a good deal of research on food habituation, which shows that people habituate to a variety of foods, like pizza, chocolate, and potato chips. Scientists describe food habituation as a form of neurobiological learning, in which repeated eating of the same food causes a decrease in behavioral and physiologic responses. Studies also show that the habituation response is delayed by eating novel foods and by stress and distraction. This works against chronic dieters in particular. Dieting heightens the novelty and desirability for the forbidden foods. When they go off the diet, dieters often eat those forbidden foods in excess, in part because of the lack of habituation. When you combine low habituation with the fear of never being able to eat a particular food, it can become a powerful force in overeating, which we call Last Supper eating. It's difficult to tire of eating a food which you think you may not ever eat again. Part of the purpose behind having unconditional permission to eat is not to get sick or burn out on a particular food. It's to experience habituation, in which the heightened novelty of eating a particular food wanes. A recent study provided the first promising evidence of long-term food habituation. Two groups of women, non-obese and obese, were given the same food with their meals, daily, over a 5-week period. This resulted in an increased rate of habituation and decreased energy intake in both groups of women. Can you really be addicted to food? There has been a lot of research speculation and media attention on food addiction. Scientists are curious because the brain region and neurochemicals involved with substance abuse are also implicated in overeating. But there are many reasons other than addiction that can explain the reward aspect of eating. Survival of the species. This brain reward system is believed to be necessary in order to ensure human survival. This involves the brain chemical dopamine, which triggers both a pleasurable feeling and motivation behavior. Engaging in activities necessary to survival, such as eating and procreating, triggers a rewarding feel-good experience. Hunger enhances reward value. Hunger by itself enhances the reward value of food through triggering more dopamine-related activity. For example, if you discover you are hungry, you might find yourself suddenly interested and motivated to cook a meal. Dieting, which can be a form of chronic hunger, also has this effect. Pavlovian conditioning. The dopamine effect could be attributed to Pavlovian conditioning. Recall the classic study in which Pavlov's dog salivated at the mere ringing of a bell. This anticipatory salivation occurred because the dogs were conditioned to receiving a treat each time after a bell rang. This is not addiction. Dopamine deprivation. Many pleasurable activities trigger dopamine, including socializing, hiking, and playing games. The great majority of people we see in our practices who binge eat are often leading very unbalanced lives. These unbalanced lives deprive them of the dopamine benefits. When needs are not being met, food becomes even more enticing, more rewarding. Music lights up dopamine brain centers. Recently, a new study showed that when people listen to music, it lights up the same region of the brain, nucleus accumbens, which has been implicated in the euphoric component of psychostimulants, such as cocaine. Just the anticipation of hearing the music lit up the dopamine brain centers. Yet we really don't think you can make the case for music addiction. Food addiction studies are limited and flawed. The research on food addiction is too much in its infancy to be drawing any conclusions. In addition, the great majority of studies have been on animals. The limited research on humans has only been focused on brain imaging studies with a very small amount of people and not much exclusion criteria. Yale Food Addiction Questionnaire. This has generated a lot of headline news. Yet, upon a closer look, the questionnaire seems to actually be measuring compulsive eating or rebound eating from chronic dieting. Here is a sampling of the questions. I find myself consuming certain foods even though I am no longer hungry. Classic compulsive eating or distracted eating can cause this. I worry about cutting down on certain foods. Chronic dieting and overeating can cause this. I have spent time dealing with negative feelings from overeating certain foods instead of spending time in important activities such as time with family, friends, work, or recreation. Chronic dieting and compulsive eating can cause this. To read more questions and details on scoring the questionnaire, see http://abcn.ws/d8FCL&Gerhardt2009. Studies show eating forbidden food decreases binge eating. Finally, there are three studies to date in which binge eaters eat their forbidden foods as part of the treatment process. Binge eating decreased significantly in all of these studies. If food addiction were an issue, you would not expect these types of results. Food addiction theory would predict increased binge eating triggered by eating addicting food. Yet the opposite happened. Chapter 8. Principle 4. Challenge the food police. Scream a loud no to thoughts in your head that declare you're good for eating minimal calories or bad because you ate a piece of chocolate cake. The food police monitor the unreasonable rules that dieting has created. The police station is housed deep in your psyche, and its loudspeaker shouts negative barbs, hopeless phrases, and guilt-provoking indictments. Chasing the food police away is a critical step in returning to intuitive eating. I felt so guilty eating an extra piece of birthday cake that when I felt nauseous for 3 days, I thought that I had earned and deserved this misery. To my surprise, I found out 1 week later that nausea was not my penance for my eating indulgence. I was pregnant. A chronic dieter. We have become a nation riddled with guilt based on how we eat. Even non-dieters experience eating angst. In a random survey of 2,075 adults, 45% said they felt guilty after eating foods they like. And nearly all of our clients also feel that way. Guilty, guilty, guilty. The thought of stealing or lying would instill a sense of guilt in most people. Yet most dieters are able to create an equivalent level of guilt when they've eaten French fries or a hot fudge sundae. The quantity of any of these bad foods has almost nothing to do with the level of despair that is felt when they are eaten. The first bite often evokes a sense of having failed or being bad. Eating a bad or illegal food then becomes a morality issue. The subsequent guilt that builds is enough to initiate a period of overeating that can destroy any previous moderate eating. Foods are often described in moralistic terms, independent of dieting: decadent, sinful, tempting. All the words of food fundamentalism and eating morality. Historian Roberta Pollack-Side concluded in her book Never Too Thin that our beliefs about food resemble dietary laws of a false religion. We pay homage to dieting and its rules, but it doesn't work. Since we are a nation that worships the lean body, it easily becomes virtuous to be eating foods associated with slimness and guiltlessness. It is no wonder that dieters have been found to think of food in terms of absence of guilt. A major finding in a 1987 study on chronic dieters at the University of Toronto found that the dieting experience appears to make the guilt-free aspect of foods a key attribute. 1 in 4 dieters categorized food using both guilt and no-guilt labels, compared to 1 out of 25 non-dieters. Dieters primarily felt guilt for highly caloric, diet-breaking foods. But dieters don't corner the market in the food guilt department. Non-dieters, in the same study, associated guilt with poor nutritional quality of foods. And the media and food companies play a hand in this, tugging at our food consciences, whether or not we are dieting. Food companies, magazines, and commercials are capitalizing on consumer eating morality with absolving themes. Be bad, snack well. They let you be bad and still be good. An ad for Snackwell's fudge-drizzled caramel popcorn. Guiltless Gourmet, a food company that specializes in fat-free snacks. It's like you dieted and went to heaven. The magazine ad for Bailey's Light. Butter paroled, margarine charged. An article in Eating Well magazine. With these daily reminders, it becomes difficult to view eating as simply a normal, pleasurable activity. Rather, it becomes good or bad, with the societal food police chastising each blasphemous bite of food. The food police are alive and well, both as a collective cultural voice and at the individual level, in the thoughts of our clients. As you embark on your journey to intuitive eating, you may encounter your fair share of societal food police, from the well-meaning friend who comments, "How can you eat that? I thought you were trying to lose weight," to unsolicited commentary on your eating habits from a stranger. Just because someone makes an inappropriate comment does not make it true. Yet it can shed seeds of doubt as you begin to explore a new eating world that runs counter to the doctrine of fat phobia orthodoxy in this nation. Some years ago on a vacation, I experienced an unwelcome food police barb. I placed my order at the customized omelet bar and requested an egg white omelet with mushrooms and cheese. The chef nearly gave me hell for my order. He reprimanded, "How can you order an egg white omelet with that fatty cheese? It's loaded with cholesterol." That unsolicited remark would have devastated most of our patients. I was on vacation and did not feel like defending my consciously placed order. I knew full well what I was doing. I don't really like egg yolks, so why eat them? I'm not crazy about cheese, but since I was pregnant during this vacation, it was one way I was able to get my calcium in, since I'm not fond of drinking milk. It was our client's worst fear personified. We have found that regardless of the level of inappropriate comments from the collective food police, the inner food police that reside in the minds of our clients are even harsher. If our nation is being possessed by a food fundamentalism, then certainly no less than a food police exorcism will do. Food talk. In the world of dieting, we develop a whole retinue of thoughts that can work against us. These thoughts can come from diet books, diet program commercials, and a generalized, pervasive diet mentality in society. Self-awareness, or having the ability to think about our thoughts, distinguishes us from animals. It's also human, however, to let our busy lives lead us from one routine activity to the next without stopping to be aware of or examine our thoughts. Food thoughts and judgments run rampant through our minds, but how often do we take a moment to focus on them? We're not born with these thoughts. We hear the ideas behind them as we grow up, take them in, and sometimes then adopt them as well-known rules, which must not be defied. Here is some of the knowledge and thoughts that prevail in the minds of our clients when they first come to see us. Sweets are bad for you. I shouldn't eat anything after 6 p.m. You should take in 0 grams of fat. Walking 3 times a week won't do me any good. If I eat breakfast, it will just make me eat more throughout the day. Dairy products are bad for you. I shouldn't have any salt. Beans are fattening. Bread is fattening. Everything is fattening. Even when these thoughts are evaluated, they stick like glue in the consciousness of the people who think them. Although there has been a great deal of evidence to refute these thoughts, they've become so well entrenched that it often takes years to loosen their hold and replace them with reality. The thoughts themselves can be very damaging and can affect subsequent behavior. These thoughts are called cognitive distortions, and we call the voices that speak these distortions the food police. Who's talking? There are many psychological ways of looking at personality structure. Psychotherapist and MD Eric Byrne tells us that the way we feel and the ways in which we act make up what are called ego states. If you watch the way a person is standing and listen to his voice, the words he uses, and the views he's stating, you'll be able to detect which ego state he is in. Dr. Byrne simply labels these ego states as the parent, the adult, and the child. He believes that at any particular time you may be in any one of these 3 ego states and can shift quite easily from one to another. Each ego state can direct the thoughts floating around in your head. You can begin to identify just which one of them is speaking by listening carefully to what is being said. We have found that in the world of dieting and eating, specific voices crop up from moment to moment, which influence how we feel and how we behave. We have extrapolated from Byrne's theory of ego structure and identified the following eating voices. There are 3 that can be primarily destructive: the food police, the nutrition informant, and the diet rebel. But we can also develop powerful allies. These voices are the food anthropologist, the nurturer, and the nutrition ally. Let's look at each food voice, how each can help or harm our thinking process in the world of eating. The food police. The food police is a strong voice that's developed through dieting. It's your inner judge and jury that determine if you are doing good or bad. The food police is the sum of all your dieting and food rules and gets stronger with each diet. It also gets strengthened through new food rules that you may read about in magazines or messages you hear from friends and family. The food police is alive and well, even when you are not dieting. Like a lobbyist positioning his issue during an election year. Here are some common rules by which the food police may judge your eating actions. Don't eat at night. Therefore, if you eat at night, you are guilty of a violation. Better not eat that bagel. It's fattening. Too many carbohydrates. You didn't exercise today. Better not eat dinner. It's not time to eat yet. Don't have that snack. You ate too much, even though it was based on being hungry. It's important to remember that even when you reject dieting and begin to make peace with food, the food police will often surface. But it's not always obvious, just like a weed cut above the surface. A weed that is strongly rooted can easily flourish, even when there are no green tendrils peeking through the soil. How it hurts. The food police scrutinizes every eating action. It keeps food and your body at war. How it helps. It doesn't. This is one voice that does not turn into an ally. By identifying its strong presence in your mind, however, you will learn how to challenge its power and loosen its hold on you. Cindy had a powerful food police voice that criticized every eating act. She woke up every morning praying for a good day, which meant eating only diet foods. But her food police voice set impossible standards. Her good day would begin with a light breakfast of grapefruit juice and a small bowl of cereal. On some days, her growling stomach would beg for more food, just an extra piece of toast. Cindy would cave in and have a piece of dry rye toast, and her food police would shout, "Now you have to skip lunch or dinner." When Cindy was able to skip lunch, she'd get too hungry and find herself at the vending machine devouring whatever she could afford. Now, once she had officially broken her food police rule, she would overeat the rest of the day. In fact, Cindy's vicious overeating cycle would begin any time she disobeyed her food police. It wasn't until Cindy began to challenge the food police voice that her overeating stopped. The Nutrition Informant. The Nutrition Informant provides nutrition evidence to keep you in line with dieting. The Nutrition Informant voice may tell you to fastidiously count carbohydrate grams or eat only fat-free foods, often in the name of health. While this may seem innocuous or even healthy, it's a facade. The Nutrition Informant makes statements like, "Check those fat grams. Anything above 1 gram of fat is unacceptable." "Don't eat foods with added sweeteners." It's not unusual for someone to say, "I've rejected dieting. I truly believe I can eat what I want. I want to start eating healthfully." It's therefore possible to consciously reject dieting, but instead unknowingly continue to diet as a politically correct regimen for keeping your weight down. How it hurts. This voice colludes with the food police. It operates under the guise of health, but it's promoting an unconscious diet. It can be a little difficult to identify because its messages can mimic the sound advice of health authorities. For example, Kelly declared, "I've made peace with food. I'm never going to diet again, but I'm ready to start eating healthfully." She was actually burned out on exploring junk foods, which in and of itself was something she never thought she would accomplish. Here's what happened. One afternoon at work, Kelly got hungry, so she honored her hunger and ate an apple in the name of healthy eating. But 1 hour later, she was hungry. Her nutrition informant voice chimed in with the food police, telling her, "You shouldn't be hungry. You just had a healthy apple. Wait until you get home to eat." She waited until she arrived at home and proceeded to devour her pantry out of ravenous hunger. Later, we talked about satisfying snacks, including a bagel or bean soup. "But aren't those fattening?" she asked. "The only snacks I thought I should eat were either fresh fruit or cut-up vegetables." Kelly's description sounded like the diet dogma of snacking, yet she did not see it as such, because she was focused on health and had sincerely rejected dieting. Yet one of Kelly's food police rules had surfaced. If you snack, you can't possibly be hungry later. This rule merged with the nutrition informant voice, which declared, if you snack, it should only be raw veggies or fruit, because they're good for you and healthy. While Kelly chose the apple in the name of health and nutrition, she had difficulty honoring her true hunger that surfaced only 1 hour later, because her food police and nutrition informant voices were overpowering, yet subtle, because she did not recognize them. How can it help? The nutrition informant becomes the nutrition ally when the food police are exiled. The newly emerged nutrition ally is interested in healthy eating with no hidden agenda. For example, if you were choosing between two brands of cheese that you like equally and you happen to have high cholesterol, the nutrition ally would advise choosing the brand with lower saturated fat. It's a choice based on health and satisfaction, not deprivation or dieting. We have found that the helpful version of this voice is one of the last to truly appear without being tied into the food police. Note, we will address nutrition later in the book. Remember, however, that focusing initially on nutrition can undermine your attempts to be truly free from dieting. It's not that nutrition is not important, but rather that it can be self-defeating in the beginning stages of intuitive eating. Remember, we are nutritionists, and we honor health. One distinguishing factor between the nutrition ally and the nutrition informant is how you feel when you respond. If you make or reject a food choice in the name of health, but feel acquiescent or guilty, then you know the food police still have a strong hold on your nutrition informant who's guiding your decision. The Diet Rebel. The voice of the diet rebel often bellows loudly in your head. It sounds angry and determined. Here are some typical statements of your internal diet rebel. You're not going to get me to eat that plain broiled chicken. I'll show you. You think I should lose 5 pounds, huh? I'll put on 10. Let's see how many cookies I can stuff in before Mom comes home. I can't wait until my husband goes out of town so I can eat whatever I want without his chastising glares. How it hurts. Unfortunately, these rebellious comments reside in your head because you're usually too scared to confront your space invaders and tell them to bug off. Feeling powerless over their messages, you feel resigned to merely possessing the thoughts you wish you could say out loud and then end up carrying out the threats just to spite them. Janie had a strong diet rebel voice. Every time her mother put her on a diet as a child, Janie's sneak eating would escalate. The diet rebel voice was Janie's primary guiding force as a child and as an adult. Janie would hang out at her friends' homes so she could eat as much of their treats as she could stuff in her mouth. Overweight as a child, Janie became morbidly obese as an adult. When her ex-husband carried on the parental diet messages, Janie's silent diet rebel became loud and angry. It was her "forget you" inner voice that directed her to go against any rules imposed upon her, which resulted in overeating. Janie's boundaries were being invaded everywhere she turned. In order to protect her autonomy, Janie's diet rebel was overpowering all other voices to help keep her independent. Yet it only ended up in private food riots of overeating. Unfortunately, when the diet rebel rules the roost, self-destruction always ensues. Rebellious behavior often has no limits, and severe overeating is usually the result. How often does the diet rebel break forth in your thoughts? How often do you feel compelled to follow its directions because you're so angry at the food police in your life imposing their dieting rules on you? How it can help. You can turn your diet rebel into the rebel ally. Use the rebel ally to help you protect your boundaries against anyone who invades your eating space. Use your mouth for words instead of food in a direct but polite way. It's surprising how powerful it can make you feel, while giving you a tremendous release. Ask your family members to stay out of your food choices or amounts. For example, Aunt Carolyn, please don't push that second portion on me. I'm full, thank you. Or, no thanks, Mom. I don't like macaroni and cheese. You know I've never liked macaroni and cheese. Tell your family and your friends and people on the street that they may not make comments about your body. For example, Dad, my body is my business. Or, Joey, you have no right to comment about my weight. The food anthropologist. The food anthropologist is simply the neutral observer. This is the voice that makes observations without making judgment. It's a neutral voice that takes note of your thoughts and actions with respect to your food world without an indictment, just like an anthropologist would observe an individual or culture. It's the voice that will let you explore and discover. The food anthropologist will help pave the way to the world of intuitive eating. For example, noticing when you're hungry or full, what you ate, the time of day, and what you're thinking are the actions of the food anthropologist. This voice simply observes and shows you how to interact with food, both behaviorally and inwardly. The advantage to developing this voice is that only you know what you feel and think. No outside observer could possibly know this. The statements of the food anthropologist are purely observational, such as, I skipped breakfast and was ravenous at 2 p.m. I ate 10 cookies. No judgment here, just the facts. I experienced guilt after eating dessert with dinner. No condescending statements, just an observation of how you felt. One easy way to call your inner food anthropologist into action is to keep an intuitive eating journal. Sometimes simply noting the time of day and what you ate can give you some interesting clues about what drives your eating. Or note your thoughts before and after you eat. Do they affect how you feel? Does your feeling state affect how you behave or eat? If so, how? Consider this one big experiment, not a tool for judgment. Many of our clients have had negative experiences with food journals because it was a requirement of past diets. But in those cases, the food journal was used as evidence to convict bad eating. We use the intuitive eating journal only as a learning tool. Yet, in spite of the fact that we stress this, our first-time clients still expect to get verbally beaten up upon their return visit for any eating indiscretion or violation. Remember, this is not a tool of the food police, but a tool to help you access the food anthropologist. How it helps. The food anthropologist can help you sort through the facts rather than get caught up in the emotionally labile experience of eating. It keeps you in touch with your inner signals, biologically and psychologically. We often play the role of the food anthropologist with our clients until they can build their own voice. It can be hard to be just neutral when you've had a critical voice harping on every food choice. The food anthropologist can help find the loopholes in your thinking, similar to the way a sharp attorney can find the loopholes in a contract. But using this voice does take practice. The nurturer. The nurturer's voice is soft and gentle and has the soothing quality that might be associated with the voice of a loving grandparent or best friend. It has the ability to reassure you that you're okay and that everything will turn out fine. It never scolds or pressures. It's not critical or judgmental. Instead, it is, or can be, the vehicle for most of the positive self-talk in your head. Here are some of the messages you might hear from the nurturer in your head. It's okay to have a cookie. Eating a cookie is normal. I really overate today. I wonder what I was feeling that could have made me need more food to comfort myself. When I take care of myself, I feel great. I'm doing so well this week. There were only a few times that I didn't honor my hunger signals. I'm getting more in touch with myself every day. Alice is a mother who usually knows just the right thing to say to her children to make them feel safe and secure. But for many years, Alice had not learned to speak to herself kindly about her weight problem. The voice of the food police punished her severely.